It is 7:30 time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, George Drafin. George is author and co-author of numerous books, including Railroads and Clearcuts, A Primer on Corporate Power, The Elite Consensus, When Corporations Wield the Constitution, and he's in to talk about his latest book that he co-authored with Derek Jensen, entitled Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests. George, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Let's start out. What is the premise behind Strangely Like War?
Well, I've been a forest activist for about 20 years, and I've worked on numerous levels, lobbying the Forest Service, lobbying Congress, trying to analyze and understand the timber industry itself and the economics behind global deforestation. And there's been some successes in the past 20 years. Particular areas have been set aside as wilderness and pollution prevention initiatives. But more than the successes, there's been failures. And I wanted to understand what was going on that so many the public is in favor of protecting forests, and there have been so many activist groups working on it, and I wanted to understand where the failure was. 80% of the world's original forests, natural forests, have been destroyed, and the destruction continues. And so what we tried to do in writing the book was to get an overview of what's happened over the past several centuries, and especially in the last century, since there's been so much deforestation.
And the title is intriguing. How did you come up with the title?
Strangely Like War is a quote from a Murray Morgan book. He was a Northwest author, and in the 1950s he wrote a book called The Last Wilderness, and we opened the book with that quote. It was strangely like war. They attacked the forest as if it were an enemy to be pushed back from the beachheads, driven into the hills, broken into patches, and wiped out. Many operators thought that they were not only making lumber, but liberating the land from the trees. And we chose that quote and the opening story of the book, which is the deforestation of the Middle East, the cradle of civilization, Mesopotamia, thousands of years ago, and the myth of Gilgamesh, which describes how the civilized city-states went out and deforested the hillsides, not only to get lumber for the cities and fuel for fires for the city, but also to wipe out the wilderness, to spread civilization and wipe out wilderness. And that's basically what we're losing now is the world's natural heritage, the great wilderness forests of the world, as industrial civilization spreads across the globe.
Well, let's talk about that. Here in the U.S., one of the statistics in your book was 95% of the forests have been removed.
Yeah. Worldwide, it's 80%. More than three-quarters of the world's natural forest, the original forest cover, is gone. And in the United States, it's 95%. You go down, we've got the statistics in the book, but you go down through the list of countries, and it's just horrifying. More than 90% of the forests in China and Vietnam and Laos, in Sweden and the United States and Mexico have been lost. More than 80% of Australia, Sri Lanka, Zaire, Malaysia, more than 70% of Russia, Indonesia, Nicaragua. The list just goes on. But I guess the one statistic you could remember is that more than three-quarters across the world has already been lost.
And as we speak, the cutting continues. Again, stats from your book, 2.5 acres a second.
Yeah, so. 150 acres a minute. 78 million acres a year. The numbers are kind of funny. Nobody actually knows. And one of the things we try to emphasize in the book is that the scientists and the government people are, activists are debating over these statistics, exactly what percentage of the forest is left. exactly what is old growth forest and what isn't. And, the numbers are not exact. Anybody that claims, you know, it's 214,000 acres a day instead of 200,000 acres a day doesn't really know what they're talking about, because nobody knows. And that's another one of the tragedies, is that we're losing a fundamental part of the natural world and of human culture. And yet we don't really even know what's happening or at what rate or what's left. More money has been put into, you know, marketing and industrial processes than into understanding what's happening to the natural world.
You mentioned old growth, and that comes up a lot in the media on critiques of cutting down our forests. What's the situation with old growth? Where are we at, based on the info you have, with how much is left?
Well, again, about 95% in the United States, and we're blessed here in the Northwest with much of the old growth that remains here in Oregon and Washington and on into Montana. Worldwide, it's lopsided like that too. Of the remaining 20% of the world's natural forests, most of it is concentrated in three countries: Russia, Canada, and Brazil. Which means that Southeast Asia and Central America and Europe and Africa have less than their share of the natural forest that remains. As far as the definition, what we're calling natural forest, or sometimes now called frontier forest, it's basically forest that hasn't been disturbed. And different kinds of forests can handle different kinds of disturbance or different levels of disturbance. But a natural forest is one that's got all of its species. It's large enough that it's actually functioning as an ecosystem. And we distinguish those from plantation forests, which sometimes the industry says, well, we've got more trees now than we did 100 years ago. And technically that's true, but you can't really compare 6 or 10 foot pulp wood trees in rows compared to 10 foot diameter old growth trees that are in a natural forest. So we're distinguishing natural forest from plantations.
And talk a little bit about the importance of old growth. Why is it such a big deal that old growth remain intact?
Oh, there's a lot of reasons. Some of them focus on the productivity of the forest itself. There's no proof, no experience in human history that you can cut and replant a forest and have it remain productive. Those areas that have been cut and planted the longest, like in Europe, they're on their third and fourth rotation of cutting and replanting, and already the trees are not growing. Disease is spreading through the plantations. The loss of soil through erosion and sterility of the soil is destroying the productive capacity of the land. So even from the point of view of producing more paper and lumber, clear cutting and replanting with a plantation is not a productive way to go. But there are more important reasons. We're losing species. Most of the large mammal species of the world are either extinct or headed that way. We're losing the smaller species, the other amphibian species, insect species, plant species. That is dangerous. To lose a genetic resource is always dangerous. Medicines, food, there's a lot of genetic destruction around the world. And also human cultures. The majority of the remaining human cultures are based in forests. They're indigenous peoples based in local forests. And as those forests are lost, those cultures are lost too. So it's not just other species or economic resources that are in danger, but human heritage itself.
Talk a little bit about the supporting structure for forestry. There's several things I wanted to ask. One is this road system that we have developed, certainly in the national forests as well as in private forests.
Yeah, in the national forests, many people in the country don't realize that our public forests are being cut. The national forests, which are owned by the public and set aside for public benefit, are being sold off to the highest bidder, often at less than the replacement cost. And along with that, the Forest Service builds the roads. There's 300,000 or 400,000 miles of road in the national forest. Sometimes there's 2 or 3 miles of road crisscrossing each square mile of forest to give access for the timber industry. And in a lot of timber operations, the worst damage comes from the roads itself more than from the cutting, like erosion. The majority of erosion from a hillside that's clear cut actually comes from the roads rather than the forest. And again, even in those areas where the forests regrow, the roads can be more or less a permanent damage to the forest, so that the damage goes on even after the trees have replanted.
One of the statistics from your book was that in the national forest, the amount of roads we've got is somewhere between 370,000 to 440,000 miles, which is actually larger than the interstate highway system.
Oh, by several times over. Yeah, there's, if you go into some of the intensively cut forest lands on the national forest or in private timberlands, the roads that crisscross back and forth are just amazing. You can use cables and drag logs up to a road, but you can only do that across a certain distance, and so roads will crisscross back and forth. You can stand on a hillside and see the roads go back and forth. It practically looks like a parking lot.
So in addition to the loss and the damage caused by removing all these trees, which we commonly call clear cuts, but I understand the forestry industry has several fairly clever names that they've come up with for that, one of which, where did it go, was temporary meadows.
Yeah. Yeah, the Forest Service, like all good bureaucrats, are experts at coming up with euphemisms, things to cover up what's going on. And that's similar to, like saying that we have more trees than we used to. Technically, that's true, but they're comparing little seedlings to, 300-foot-high old-growth trees that have been there for 1,000 years. So they're comparing apples and oranges.
Another term I liked was the that strip when you're driving along a road, particularly here in Washington State.
The beauty strip, yeah. Yeah, that's actually how I discovered what was going on in the forest. I was out here as a teenager visiting family, and we were driving through Snoqualmie Pass, and I had never been in the mountains before, and I'd never seen trees that big before, and I was just amazed, and my uncle pulled over, and we got out of the car and we walked to the side of the road and walked about 50 feet in, and I could see the clear cuts behind it, and so I was in awe of the forest, and I was simultaneously shocked by seeing what the beauty strip was and what was going on behind the little facade.
So, in addition to the loss of trees, the additional damage by the erosion and the fact that there's no infrastructure there basically left after those trees are removed.
Yeah, and the soil for long-term productivity, one of the worst things is the soil is destroyed. In a typical clear cut, the trees are removed. In the process, there's bulldozers and heavy equipment driving back and forth on the soil, crushing the soil structure. The limbs and the waste that isn't taken out is piled up and then burned, which sterilizes the soil. The soil is a living structure with billions of organisms in a square foot of soil. Fungus and mycorrhizae that protect the roots and carry nutrients to the roots of the trees. So when the soil is disturbed, that again can become a permanent problem that reduces the productivity of the forest. It's been known for several decades that in the tropics, most of the biological material and the nutrients of the forest are actually tied up in the trees, so that when you clear cut an area and take those trees out, there's nothing left in the soil. The recycling of the nutrients is so fast in the tropics that the nutrients go up into the trees, and then the trees die and decompose, and the nutrients go back in the soil. So when the trees are removed, you're left with a sterile soil, and it quickly becomes a hard pan that can't grow trees. They're discovering now that the same thing happens in the northern forest, in the boreal forests of northern Canada and Siberia, where you have permafrost. The ground is permanently frozen. The top layer of the ground is permanently frozen. And when you remove those trees, the sunlight hits the soil for the first time and melts the permafrost, and the nutrients and the water, everything takes off from the soil. And again, you end up with a swamp instead of a forest, and again, you can't replant. So in the tropics and in the northern forests, you get to cut once, and then you've destroyed the structure of the soil, and the forest will not regrow.
If one were to exclusively listen to the industries that do the cutting, you would get the impression that there's constantly trees coming down for different reasons, and that if we don't go in and extract those trees, that's wasted wood, revenues flushed down the toilet. Address that, if you would.
Well, the world's not a factory, and that's basically what the industry is trying to turn it into. And we as a civilization have, you know, come to look at the world as a factory full of resources for our consumption. But again, the nutrients are tied up in a cycle between the trees and the undergrowth story and herbaceous plants that are growing in a full ecosystem. And if you remove those trees, then for every species that goes extinct in a forest, eventually up to 10 other species will also go extinct because of the interdependence between those species. In the old growth forests here in the Northwest, there are voles and other rodent species that have spent generation after generation in the same tree. You'll get 15th and 20th generations of a vole family that lives in a tree. And, you know, in our kind of entertainment and industrial-oriented culture, we think, well, those little voles, they're like cartoon characters or something. But they actually distribute by eating pine needles and dropping them in feces onto the ground. You're actually redistributing the mycorrhizae soil. Again, that fungus is necessary for the nutrient uptake of the tree. So you lose those voles, you lose the productive capacity of the forest for certain species of trees. And so you have a complex ecosystem, and we're trying to mine as much of the wood fiber as we can for paper production or lumber production. And you cannot treat a forest that way. It doesn't. You know, the industry often compares forestry to farming. You know, cut the trees and replant them. A forest is just like a cornfield. Well, even a cornfield isn't like a cornfield. We're now removing 3 bushels of soil for every bushel of corn we're growing in the Midwest. It's obviously not sustainable. And yet we have this mechanical mindset that thinks we can treat the forest like a warehouse and we can just remove resources from it. And it doesn't work that way. Even from an intelligent economic standpoint, you cannot remove resources that way and have them replaced.
Another impression one would get from listening to the media was this last summer we saw a lot of forest fires down in California. We had a couple here in Washington State, and there was a whole bunch up in British Columbia. And one would get the impression from listening to the critics that the whole cause of those forest fires were the fact that environmentalists didn't let the timber industry into the forest to properly clear cut and or thin like they wanted. What's your take on that?
Well, that's, yeah, that's, to hear the industry tell it, it's a good thing that, that white folks got here with their chainsaws, because the forest would have gone extinct if we hadn't. It's, the environmentalists have delayed less than 5% of timber sales. The vast majority of timber sales go just as the bureaucrats and the industry want them to go. So that's one fact that's, it's just not true that environmentalists are tying up the forest. The second interesting thing about those fires last summer, you know, Congress passed the Healthy Forest Initiative to go out and cut 20 million more acres of public lands. After those fires last summer, well, the biggest fires, 600,000 acres, were down in suburban San Diego, which, number one, doesn't have a timber industry. It had nothing to do with forests. That was burning in chaparral and desert. And it was burning in the suburbs. They're building at such a rate, spreading into the forest areas in Southern California, that of course you're going to get fires. The kids go out and smoke cigarettes, and slob hunters run around and start fires. Of course it's going to burn, but it has nothing to do with forests. So as usual, the government and the industry has taken they've taken a fire in chaparral in Southern California and somehow turned it into cutting forest in Montana. So it's a propaganda and a twisting of the facts.
I understand another contributor to the fire is actually the clear cuts themselves, where they take out the largest trees, which normally would be resistant to fire, and they leave the smaller scraggly trees, which are, you know, then dry out and are perfect fire starters.
Right. And most large forest fires actually start in timber cutting operations. Most forest fires start from lightning. They're natural fires, but most of those are very small, just a few acres at a time. The large fires, the large catastrophic fires that are burn, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres and actually do damage, are invariably started by humans, and they're usually started in logging operations. That again, you know, that's in forests. The largest fires last summer were down in San Diego, where there's no timber industry at all.
Let's talk a little bit about the what happens to the wood after it gets cut. The processing itself is a pretty toxic endeavor. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, it is. The global wood and paper industry is being driven by paper. That's paper consumption doubles every 10 years. It's been doing that since World War II. The propaganda that the computer age was going to reduce paper use is nonsense. Everybody's got a computer and a printer in their house now, and everybody's a desktop publisher. In the old days, if you printed a piece of paper, you know, you were writing a letter and you made a typo halfway through, you wouldn't crumple the thing up and start over again. So paper use is doubling every decade, and that's what's driving the industry. There are warehouses full of lumber and panels, more than can be consumed, because out of a tree, about half of it can go to pulp and paper, and the other half can go to lumber and panels. And so whole forests are coming down in order to provide the paper industry, which is extremely toxic. There's many toxic chemicals that are used in paper production, and the paper industry is one of the largest consumers of energy and water in the country. And yet the research and development for reducing the pollution is one of the smallest of any industries. And in fact, in Europe, they've been bleaching paper, manufacturing paper without chlorine bleach, one of the most toxic chemicals that's used, for many years. And the industry here in the United States says they can't switch over to chlorine-free bleaching. It's just not competitive. And yet the industry they're competing with is the European paper manufacturers that have been doing it for years. So it's a combination of stubbornness and refusal to to invest in their own industry, along with ignorance on the part of the consumer. And it's consumption itself. Another thing we tried to talk about in the book was that it's easy to slam the industry when they're so stubborn and so out of step with what the public wants. But the public is the one that's consuming this stuff. 3/4 of the world's wood and paper is consumed by 16% of the world's population. That's us in the U.S. and Europe and Japan are consuming 3/4 of the world's paper production, wooden paper. And I mean, in the U.S. we consume more than 700 pounds of paper a year per person. The average in non-industrialized countries is 12 pounds. So a human does not need 700 pounds of paper to survive, but that's what we're consuming in the U.S. And as long as that demand is there, the industry is going to do everything it can to supply that demand.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the solutions. We only have a few minutes left. One thing I was encouraged by in your book was that recycling appears to be growing here in the U.S.
Yeah, our book really has it's taken the long view, looked at the global situation, and really focused on the facts of the damage. And a lot of people have come away from the book being depressed. But if you actually read the book, the entire last section of the book is looking at the solutions. And there have been a lot of them. People are working on consumption, reducing packaging and the use of disposable paper, which is the majority of paper. The majority of trees are cut for paper, and the majority of paper goes into tissue and packaging and other disposable products. So consumption can easily be reduced without destroying our quality of life. Recycling of paper, only about half of the waste paper in this country is recycled. Here in Seattle, we've got a municipal recycling system, so we may think that recycling is taken care of, but that's not true in much of the rest of the country. Engineers are working on pollution prevention, finding ways to close the loop of the toxic chemicals that are used in paper making. People are attacking the taxpayer subsidies like the road building and other forms of subsidies that the timber industry gets. People are working on sustainable forestry and certification of forestry operations to be sure that the indigenous people aren't being exploited, that clear cutting isn't destroying the productive capacity of a forest. And there's a lot of restoration forestry going on. And about half of the world's logging is actually technically illegal. So there are a lot of regulations and laws on the books already that simply aren't being enforced. So we survey all of these things and include a list of groups that are working on certification and sustainable forestry and pollution prevention and these other solutions. There's a lot that people can get involved in, and there's a lot being done to improve the way wood and paper is being manufactured. But in the end, these are technical solutions to technical problems. They should be done, they are being done, and they should be done. They should be pushed as far as they can. But in the end, the loss of the world's forests is not a technical problem. It's a political problem. It's a social problem, maybe a spiritual problem, that we have to turn the world into a factory and that we have to consume our natural and human heritage. And there's no technical solution to that. In the end, what we need is a deep change in the social system and in the way we live. And we try to point that out in the book, too, that if you have a social or a spiritual problem, that you can't come up with a technical or engineering solution to it.
We are talking with George Drafin, co-author of Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests. George, how can people get in contact with you and find out more about this?
Well, folks can get a hold of the publisher of Stranded Like War, Chelsea Green, at chelseagreen.com. Many people know Chelsea Green is a lifestyle and sustainable living publisher. They've now started publishing political books as well. So chelseagreen.com is a way they can find out more from our publisher. The two authors of the book, Derek Jensen, can be reached at derekjensen.org. And I can be reached at my website, which is endgame.org.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you. Glad to be here.